The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. Welcome to the Secure in Mind podcast. Today's guest, I am extremely excited to have a conversation with. He is none other than the whistleblower extraordinaire, William Binney. We're going to get into a lot of his background, as we always do on this podcast, a bit of a backstory as to how he came to be who he is in a professional sense, and also focus on the past and some of the aspects that drove him to become very famous in many senses and infamous, depending on the side, the employment whistleblower. Some would say potentially one of the guys who may or may not have inspired Edward Snowden, who is, I guess, another generation of whistleblowers. So, yeah, look, I'm absolutely privileged to be interviewing you, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Nick. I'm glad to be with you.
Fantastic. So let's set the stage. How far we go back is your determination, but give us a sense of, I guess, what got you involved in the industry that you were in. Was it an early in mathematics, cryptography, et cetera, computers? And then, you know, give us a sense of how you rose through the ranks in the National Security Agency. We'll get up to the point where, I guess, you did decide to raise the red flag over one of the projects.
Well, let me go back to my schooling and the training I had. In university, I started out as a chemistry major for the first 2 years. But toward the end of it, I had a few experiences, like the fellow on one side of me in the lab poured concentrated sulfuric acid on his arm. And the other side was put an ether solution on top of a Bunsen burner to distill it, and it blew up. So when I'm sitting there when these guys are doing it, it's on either side. You know, we have these partitions, so that protected us.
Yeah.
And then the final point with my chemistry major, the entire lab blew up over the weekend. Pond lab. The whole thing was like a 250-foot lab. The whole thing blew up because it was a graduate study going down. It was probably a contract for the government. And they had experiments running all the time. You know, it was running for the full length of the lab. And so it lost equilibrium somewhere, and the whole thing blew up.
Oh my God.
This is obviously a dangerous profession. I'm leaving this one.
Yeah, anything other than that. International intelligence. No worries.
So I went to physics, you know, after that.
Yep.
And then when they started talking about, well, we've got this mathematical, along the same time, I was taking math all the time. So, but physicists, you know, they started talking about, well, you know, we had this inductive proof that as a particle approaches the speed of light, its mass goes to infinity, you know?
Mm.
And they had this inductive proof. And I looked and I said, that's not an inductive proof. See, because the whole point is you prove your hypothesis for cases 1, 2, and 3, say, then you assume it for the nth case, n being anything, mm-hmm. and prove it for the n+1 case. That's an inductive proof.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, let the n be the speed of light, and I'll prove it for the speed of light +1. Then you've got an inductive proof.
Okay.
So I said, you guys are approximationists. I'm going back to pure math where things are a little more concrete and clear.
Okay.
So that's how I ended up in math. And then as a part of that, see, this is back in, I was getting out of school in 65, and this was getting to the point where Vietnam was cranking up, you know, and they were taking people from my neck of the woods. You know, we were hunters, you know, outdoors mm-hmm. people, and, you know, had good shots with a rifle. And so,
Did you grow up? Where were about?
Central Western Pennsylvania, in the wilderness of Pennsylvania, woods okay. and you know farms and mines and woods and
yeah,
very few people there. So you could be a mile away from somebody if you were out living out in the country, you know.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, at that time in '65, the Vietnam War was cranking up, and you know people in my neck of the woods were getting drafted and sent to in the rifle companies, making sweeps through Vietnam.
Mm.
So I didn't particularly want to do that, go over there and kill anybody. I didn't like killing anything, period. So I didn't want to do that. So I looked at my options before they drafted me, you know, and they said, well, you can join and choose your first assignment. I said, that sounds great to me. I said, great, I'll join. And he said, I'll sign up for volunteer for Europe. And he said, well, now, you know, if you sign up for 4 years, we can put you in this analysis section. And that basically said, you know, that was basically Army intelligence. Then I got into the Army Security Agency, and they give me a battery of tests. They said, you know, you really have this aptitude for analysis, you know. And that was the mathematics background discipline, you know.
How did they assess that in the Army?
They have batteries of tests they give to everybody that come in, and they get, that shows their aptitudes for different areas.
Yep.
And then it gives them like an idea of where the Army can get the best benefit from assigning them.
Okay.
So that's what they did. Put me in the Army Security Agency, and they said, we'll now send you to Europe. So I ended up in Turkey.
Wow.
I said, wait a minute. You know, we just passed the Bosporus. This is Asia.
Yeah.
No, my boy. They said, no, my boy. I'm sorry. You signed up and for Europe. That's the European theater. That's NATO. Turkey's a part of NATO. So you're still in Europe, in the European theater.
Yep.
I said, oh, okay. I didn't understand that. You know, okay, I thought we were going with the
physics. I need to refresh my map.
I got to change my map around. Right. So I was over there for a year and a half, and I had a lot of, I started having a lot of fun there, solving problems against the Soviet Union and the Soviet military. And that got me noticed with NSA. And they said, gee, we'd like you to come back here. And so when they request people, they generally get it. So. So I got orders to be assigned to back to NSA in June of 1967. That was right after the Six-Day War.
Wow.
Now, at the same time, this is a little backstory here for you. At the same time, the NCOIC, the analysis section at the site there where I was in Turkey, came to me and said, how would you like to take a boat ride in the Mediterranean? You know?
So, yeah.
And I had three answers to that. I said, first of all, I'm not in the Navy.
Yeah.
Secondly, I don't tread water very well.
Yep.
And third, I've got orders back then to go back to NSA for assignment. Thank you, but thank you.
And that's not anything to do with ordnance and blowing stuff up. I've already seen my chemistry lab. Not interested.
Yeah, that's right. Well, see, the point was they wanted me to go on the USS Liberty ship.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the one the Israelis shot up, knowing it was the U.S. ship, by the way.
Yeah.
He had an airborne platform over there, copying their air-to-ground command and control system for the fighters.
Wow.
And also the boats.
Yeah.
And so they were ordered, they kept complaining it was a U.S. ship, and they kept saying, shoot it.
Wow.
So it was all done deliberately. And my guess was they didn't want us collecting, because it was a SIGINT ship. So my guess is they didn't want us collecting, communications showing their violations of international law against prisoners or something like that. You know.
And the response?
The response in the U.S., they got a mayday off the ship.
Yeah.
We had an aircraft carrier in the web and in the wet Mediterranean there, and they launched F-4s, I believe they were, at the time. To give air cover to the Liberty ship, and when President Johnson discovered what was going on and that the admiral there had launched airplanes to give air cover, he ordered those planes back because he didn't want to embarrass his ally. So in the meantime, 34 Americans were killed, 170 some wounded, you know, and they kept shooting that ship. It didn't sink. That's the only reason that some of them stayed alive.
Wow.
And our president doing that just told me everything that we were was meat on the line. That's all. We didn't matter.
Yeah.
So I only stayed in for 4 years, got out. So, but I got back to NSA, and then I got into doing larger scale problems, you know. And
yeah.
For me, scale was no impediment. I mean, some people are intimidated by large
problems. Yeah.
But when you're a mathematician, you know, it's just another number. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, another zero.
Like I said in the movie, A Good American, you know, about me, I said, you know, when I proposed to graphing all the relationships of every phone in the network of the world, you know, everybody, people at NSA said, you can't do that, that the combinations are infinite.
Yep.
And I said, no, they're not. I said, just think of it this way. At any instantaneous point in time,
yeah,
where everything stops, right? Yep. The numbers of atoms in the universe are finite.
Yeah.
Now you can get your mind around it.
Yeah. Right?
It's bigger than the number of combinations in the phone network. So, hey, this is now simple. You can now get your mind around it and solve it. But you see, most people are impeded by that, or they get overpowered by that. They think it's too many combinations. It's infinite. And once you assume that, you're immediately defeated. You can't solve anything.
So, yeah, you've locked yourself in that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Fallible logic prism. So the initial time in NSA, you've moved back to the United States, you're working in the NSA. As much as you can tell, what type of projects were you working on? What type of things were you developing? Because I guess for listeners who are of, say, my generation, you know, 30s or younger, they've known nothing else but the internet. But we're talking about, what, early 70s, isn't it? So what were you working on? What type of pieces were you working on?
Well, it was back then. It was analog, and so it turned out to be again. We had satellite back then, and also HF, VHF, UHF, FHF kind of broadcasts, and also going all the way down to ELF, which would penetrate down through the oceans. You know, and of course, it went ELF, VLF, MF, HF, VHF, UHF, VHF. You know, SHF. You know.
Yeah.
The whole spectrum.
Yeah.
Communications of people. I was not involved in the communications between devices, you know, like that's radar and telemetry and things like that. So
yeah.
I was involved in people communicating with other people anywhere in the world, and it was basically any means of communication. So my primary target was the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact then. So
with that, was it necessary for you to learn Cyrillic and to learn Russian as well? Or did you have a team of translators?
Yep. I had to do that too because, you know, people couldn't translate it properly.
Yeah.
Because when you got into technical terms, unless you knew what the technical stuff was, you couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
And they were failing at that miserably. So I had to get into it. And when I got into it, I started to, then I would go to the linguists and tell them how to understand what they're reading.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like you have to do with lawyers today. You have to go and train them in what the technology is all about so they can understand how to express, you know, objections in a court of law.
Yeah.
It's a highly specialized jargon-based system anyway, so.
Out of interest, when you were both in Turkey and also in NSA working on Soviet cases, was there any sense of almost competition with some of your rivalries on the other side? Did you sense that? Or is that a mythology that movies play a part in?
No. There were rivalries in between CIA and NSA and FBI.
Interdepartmental.
All of them, yeah.
Okay.
It basically boiled down to nobody wanted to share anything they knew because if they did, everybody would know it, you know. And if they knew it, then you had no leverage over them. You couldn't say I know more than they do, and therefore I get credit for, you know, getting the answer out there, you know.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing about what
also GCHQ, by the way, same thing.
GCHQ, you know, ASD. You know, I'm. You can tell by my accent, I'm from the land down under, and. Yeah, no, it's amazing though how institutions are able to conjure up this certain level of privilege or certain symbolic foundation within our minds. And yes, absolutely, they serve a fundamental core principle which ensures in some parts that rule of law still exists, security still exists. But in others, you can see in I guess if you humanize it, that's humanized. The problem with humans, which is, you know, we're selfish, unsharing, we're jealous, we want the credibility, and that's just at the interdepartmental level. You know, CIA keeping some of their knowledge because they don't get the cred.
it's that fundamental human problem.
Frailty, yeah.
And it basically goes like this. Well, it's the group mentality. If you're in the group, it's us and them.
Yeah.
You know, everybody in the group is us. Everybody out is them.
Yeah.
Like I refer to with the Hillary and all the experience we had recently with the attempted soft coup.
Yeah.
I refer to the Department of Justice as the Department of Just Us, and we're not included. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a great mobilizer, isn't it? As well. Okay, so that's NSA. Let's move forward to when things, I guess, started to get hairy, if I can use that generalization. So in 2002, looking at my notes, yourself, Mr. Weber, Mr. Loomis, asked the Inspector General to investigate the NSA for wasteful spending on Trailblazer. And then this was, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was the catalyst to everything, I guess, whether you call it falling apart or coming together, I don't know. Again, that's up to you. But so let's set from there. And
yeah, let me back up a bit here.
Yep, sure.
1997. In 1997, I became the technical director of World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting.
Yep.
In NSA, and that basically was the position of seeing the technical issues with the world. And so there was about 6,000 analysts in that group.
Wow.
So they were reporting on every country in the world.
Yep.
So the main problem I saw there was the digital explosion of communications and the fact that the analysts were being buried every day by their queries, the way they were querying data.
Mm.
And they're still doing that today, by the way. Nothing changed. So that was the main problem I saw that we needed to solve for those 6,000 analysts, you know, so that they could effectively see. We needed to make the content problem a manageable problem so that they could get through it and actually see threats coming.
Yeah.
And alert people so we could actually do something to avert, you know, some kind of attack or crisis or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you can't get through the material, you can't see the threat and you can't report it. So nobody knows it. And people keep getting killed like all these attacks that terrorists do because, you know, well, they're all committed by known people. But, you know, there's too much data and they can't get through it. So obviously people die.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So what I did was design a way to define the query, the data, extract data from the flow of information through the entire worldwide network.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Loomis, my partner, was doing the front-end sessionizing of the data. That is, when it was packetized, you know, passing around a package, he would pull all the packets together and reassemble the email or file or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Then he presented it to me. So he said, here, Bill, take this. You know, I'm getting it at fiber optic rates, you know?
Yeah.
And multiple fiber lines. So, you know, here it comes. And I have to design. How can I do this, you know? So
yeah.
I devised a deductive, inductive, abductive rules to be able to pull out only the, basically pull out in the terminology, they do, pull out the needles and potentially associated needles from the haystack and let the whole haystack go right by.
Okay.
Well, that meant that now we boiled everything down to a rich environment for our analysts to succeed, you know, and it was all relevant data.
Mm.
And the potential needles weren't necessarily guilty simply because they were pulled in by the rules, but you had to be, what it meant was we call that the zone of suspicion.
Mm.
They're exhibiting human properties or behavior that means that that justifies probable cause to get a warrant to look at them to resolve whether or not they're part of that international crime or whatever activity it is.
Okay.
So, and those rules basically at the same time, when they filtered everything out that was relevant, it let and left everything else go by, it gave everybody in the world privacy because nobody had their data.
Mm.
And then once we pulled people in, if we didn't know who they that they were actively participating, we would encrypt all their attributes so you couldn't tell who it was.
So no one knew anything else. You're solving the security privacy argument with that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. So that basically masked who the people were, but it still lets you see the data so you can see whether or not they're actually participating.
Mm.
If they're not participating, say this person's not part of it, we'll delete them.
Yeah.
If they were participating, you got the warrant. And
open it up.
Yeah. And so, and we had deductive and inductive and abductive approaches to doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that protected the identities of people who weren't necessarily known, but under zone of suspicion. And then the final thing was we had a program that audited who came into our network, looked at our data and what they did with the data and how long they stayed and things like that.
Mm.
That meant we would know, for example, if Edward Snowden started downloading, we would know within about 10 to 20 milliseconds that he was doing it.
Hmm.
So we would know right away. In other words, you can get away with it. But here's what the NSA management and the intelligence management did with it. First, they said, and this was basically designed by organized by Bush, Cheney, Hayden, and Tenet. Hayden was director of NSA. Tenet was the director of CIA. and Cheney, president and vice president. Mm-hmm. So, and their lawyers wrote, crappy legal arguments that wouldn't stand up to any scrutiny in the light of day. So they kept it all secret. So nobody could see it. All right. So they justified things legally in secret. That meant we had a secret government, right? And secret laws and secret everything. Mm. So anyway, what they did was they first, Cheney wanted to know everything about all his political enemies and all his potential political enemies, or anybody that would try to stand up and oppose the policies of his administration.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that meant he wanted to know everything about everybody.
Yeah.
And Hayden knew that we had the capacity to do this. So he said, okay, we'll open up by first removing the filtering. So that meant they could take everything in, right? It was now able to take everything in.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're going to remove all the encryption. So now all the identities there. So they take everything in and they know who everybody is.
And that the balance that you struck between security.
Right. It's all gone
out the window.
And then they removed the third phase, which was the auditing program.
Mm.
Because they didn't want anybody to know what they were doing with the data.
Hmm. So essentially, no oversight either.
That's right. There isn't. In fact, they have no idea what NSA is doing. Most of them, the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, are all virtually worthless. Mm. They're not oversight. They're overlooked, as Ray McGovern would call it. Actually, they're not. They're advocates. They're not even overlooking. They're advocates for all this.
Mm.
So. And the FISA court has no idea what's happening. I mean, they only know what they're told, and that's all it is. So, and they get lied to all the time, and they know it.
Yeah.
But they haven't done anything to it. They haven't done anything to stop it.
Yeah.
So we have a charade, as I call it, a charade that we're following the Constitution and the laws. It's just a fake.
Yeah.
So at any rate, that's what we objected to the Department of Defense Inspector General. Mm. Also, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice.
Mm.
And we also took it to the members of Congress in the committees, the intelligence committees.
Mm.
And so, according to the Senator Feinstein, who said that Snowden should have stayed in proper channels, we were doing that. We were staying in proper channels. The only thing that did was get the FBI to raid us and point guns at us.
And that was going through the proper channels.
Yeah. And then after the raid, the Department of Justice tried to indict us three separate times under the Espionage Act, 35 years in jail, and they fabricated evidence to do it. And the first two times I caught them, and I just told our lawyer, and he said, you people better back away from here because you're fabricating this evidence. They went away on that. But the third time they came back and just simply declared to our lawyer they're going to indict. And that was in late 2009.
So I'm curious as to the emotional and the human element to this. I mean, you're serving great aspects within the National Security Agency. It does inevitably stop a lot of things happening, which you assisted in. How do you feel? It's almost like you're being betrayed for saying the right thing. Is that a?
Well, you see, after the Department of Justice tried to indict us the third time, I'd accumulated evidence of malicious prosecution. And I told them, okay, let's go to court. I've got all this evidence. And I told them what the evidence was. And so, they backed off and gave us letters of immunity, unsolicited. I know our lawyer had nothing to know. He didn't know what happened because I never told him what I did, So anyway, I throughout this entire process, there were two reactions, Ed and Kirk were, and Tom were more afraid. In fear of them. I was angry as hell.
Yeah.
I didn't know that when they raided me, because I knew why they were there.
Yeah.
They were sent there to keep us quiet.
Yeah.
Because this was what they were doing was unconstitutional and impeachable.
Yeah.
So I was dealing with it with anger. And to me, that when they tried to indict us, that was the last straw. And then I went home.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to put up with this anymore. And I'm still not. I've got three separate lawsuits I'm supporting here. One in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and one in the Third Circuit. The latest development is the Third Circuit wants to hear oral arguments now. Now, this is what the government has tried to stop from happening.
Sorry, this is current. This is ongoing.
Current. The oral arguments are going to be scheduled in September. And that means, they tried to hide all what they're doing. And I exposed that in my affidavit for the Third Circuit. And the lawyer running it has been told the court will hear oral arguments over the government's objectives You know, they can object all they want. The court's hearing oral arguments because, you know, we just have so much proof of what's going on. It's just, I mean, I've been assembling it all along. So,
yeah.
And one of my better sources, by the way, was Mueller when he was director of the FBI.
Huh.
Because he never knew what he was saying. He just said things and thought that nobody knew what that meant. Boy, that hit point right with me. I said, oh, tells me what they're doing, you know, and here it is. And so I capture all these things and I say, this is what this means here, you know, and I point up here and I can point right to the Snowden material. See, that's what that's saying over there, too. That's exactly what they're doing. Yeah. So
I
point this out in my affidavit in the court of law.
So do you feel confident?
I mean, if nothing else, then we get to read all this in the public domain.
Yeah.
This is what they didn't want. This is sunlight on their crimes, which, by the way, I keep pointing out also to the lawyers included. Executive Order 13526, which is the executive order that governs classification for the entire U.S. government, says in Section 1.7, you cannot classify, maintain classified, or not declassify evidence of a crime, fraud, waste, abuse, criminality, or corruption of any kind. A good deal of what Edward Snowden produced is evidence of a crime that cannot be classified. So they can't claim that even under the regulations they have. They're trying to ignore. We don't, you know, that's behind the curtain. We didn't see that.
This is
the Wizard of Oz game. You know, don't pay any attention to the man behind the curtain.
Yeah. And then introduce straw man. Hang on. Let's stick to
that. We're through that now. We're going to oral argument. And that means that discovery and deposition, all that kind of stuff is imminent.
So watch this space. It's going to be a fascinating. Yeah. How long do you expect the journey to take from September?
A number of months, you know, maybe a couple of years.
Yeah,
but we're still going. But the point is, the court's going to ask us, what should we do as a court?
Yeah.
We should order the stop of bulk acquisition of data and the cleanup of the database that NSA has accumulated.
Yeah.
Getting rid of anybody that they don't have a warrant on.
Yeah.
For example, that would wipe out, and the way to do that is to apply the deductive, inductive, abductive rules that we have to do, targeted, professional, disciplined approach to data analysis and analysis of the targets you're interested in.
Yeah, their rebuttal would be, well, we need to monitor some threats, and your rebuttal is quite simple. I designed that years ago.
Yeah, I got them all. Actually, you can go back to every attack that's ever happened before and after 9/11, including 9/11. All the people that participated would have been picked up by this approach.
Yeah,
and it's demonstrable. Tom Drake ran it after we left. He ran it in February of 2002 against the entire database and found that they had all this information down there on the imminent attack, even the date of the attack, you know, and they didn't know they had it. It was buried in their data. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that's going on. That's why people are getting killed all over the place and they're not stopping it.
Yeah.
I mean, take the example of the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris. They had that attack, but then French came out and said, we need another €1 billion. We need another 1,000 analysts. We need more data.
Mm.
And they got all of that. And then 8 months later, they had another attack in Paris. And it was done by people who were known in both cases. If you focused in and had a disciplined approach and looking at the people you know and have behavioral properties that suggest you need to watch them, then you'd have that stuff and could see them preparing these things.
So I have a question. With your background and your know-how and your former, 30 years of service in the NSA, are there any, you know, like minds who are still in the institution? And have you ever thought or have you ever sought to communicate or sort of amend beyond the legal ramifications of the actions that you've decided to undertake to implement some of these controls anyway? Or is that just a no-go zone?
Well, you see, I can't talk to anybody in the organization now. You know, people have done that with Tom Drake, even when he was under suspicion and not under indictment or anything. Why? Those people were fired for that, just for talking to him. So, you know, if I did that, they would be
they're gone.
Under the grill. You know, so I don't do that to them. So,
yeah, no, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
So, moving on to another topic that I would love to explore, Russiagate. tell us all.
the total fraud from the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. I got that sense. Let's pull the thread on that. So, can you for the listeners, because again, the audience is predominantly Italian, broadly European, Dutch, some Dutch listeners as well. I had a great guest from Holland, and that it might be of interest to you, because the final thing to discuss is your project, Pretty Good Knowledge, which I understand is based in Amsterdam. But yes, before that, Russiagate, tell us all from the beginning to where it is now.
Well, when they first started talking about the, you know, Russiagate back in August of 2016, shortly after Julian Assange started opening up and exposing the emails that the DNC and Hillary Clinton and some of that, you know, they started to create this Goose for Two thing, you know, and also alleging the Russians hacked, you know, by using people who were surrogates in the network. Like IRA, the Internet Research Agency, and the court just threw that out because the court challenged the government, said, "Where's the proof that they're an agent of the Russians?" And the government said, "Well, we don't have any." And the judge said, "Get the hell out of my court," basically. So, you know, and the same thing was true with Lucifer too. I mean, we could prove that.
So which court, though? We
talked. It was a federal court in D.C., I believe.
Okay, yeah.
Or in Virginia. I'd have to look it up. It's on the web.
Yeah.
If you Google IRA and federal court, you know, you should be able to get the statements that the judge made, which were, you know, basically dressing down the government for doing what they did.
Yeah.
I mean, because they didn't expect anybody to come into court and challenge it. Well, IRA did, and you know, so the Russians, so they had to write the discovery, and they had nothing. That was just a wild ass statement by the government to fit the narrative that they were pushing.
Yeah.
The Russians did it. Why? They wanted to take everybody's view away from what was said in the emails. They didn't want anybody looking at Hillary and all her crimes, exposing classified material on 40, I think about 40 SAPs, special access programs. One of them was Gamma. You know, it was a straight exit. I'll explain that in a minute. That's a special access program where we were actually reading an encryption system.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wrote a report based on the decrypt of that system, and that was lifted out verbatim from a Gamma report and sent to Hillary and her private server and exposed the entire world. Now, not only you have to understand what that means. In cryptology, that means, gee, we have the capability and the technology to break an encryption system of this complexity.
Yeah.
Okay, so that now exposes our capability. And it also says, hey, what system is that? Oh, it's this one. Well, anybody else in the world now knows that their system is compromised and they are no longer secure. So that wipes out all those windows that we were looking at all the countries around the world using that encryption system.
That's incredible.
So the damage was
catastrophic. Yeah.
Just in that one SAP, and there were like 40 of them in there. So 30 or 40, I can't remember what the number was, but also she had other classified material in there. I mean, you know, we had a kid, a poor young kid who was in a nuclear submarine and took a picture of himself in the area where he worked in the sub.
Mm.
And he didn't realize that the background showed knobs and control things and things like that that was classified or sensitive to government.
Okay.
So when he took it home, he had it on his phone and he was showing it to his kids and his family, and he got it on his phone.
A stupid selfie, but at the
end. Yeah, yeah. And so what happened? He claimed the Hillary Clinton defense, okay?
Is that what No.
Look what Hillary did. Look what Hillary did. You know, look what I did. I said, you know, I didn't know this was happening. It didn't spread it around. Like, I didn't put it on the net, so it wasn't exposed to everybody, you know? So the judge says, no, that's not going to work. You know, you're going to go to jail for 30 months. So
yeah.
So they put him in jail for 30 months, and Hillary, of course, walked free.
Yeah, you don't have the name. Yeah.
That's where I started saying, well, now, you know, this is clearly the Department of Justice, us, and we're not included.
Mm. You know, it's crazy because, I mean, I've spent time in the different countries, which, you know, we like to slap on the title developing, right, or third world, second world, first world. But, you know, it's arguable as to what that constitutes. Or,
yeah.
There are arguments to and for. Anyway, putting aside the philosophical discussion about that, I remember there was a case. I lived in Cambodia for a number of years, and next door I used to visit all the time in Thailand for business. And there was a case of a guy who was the son of an army general from memory, and he was driving his Ferrari or Lamborghini again. I can't remember the details specifically. Obviously, some creative Google searching will find this case. And there was massive uproar because the guy was drunk, high, smashed into a bus stop, you know, the water covering bus stop, killed two people. I'm pretty sure it was a pregnant lady, but I'm, you know, a good Google search will be able to identify. Gets off. No prison sentence, no nothing. I think it was a good behavior bond or a home detention for 6 months or something like that. And in my mind, I was thinking, well, you know, it's Thailand. As far as if we're going to horribly classify, you know, third, second, first world at the time, I guess it was second world, developing nation, it makes sense. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's just, you know, putting lipstick on a pig, right? You just shift. Sure.
I actually think that many years ago, Goethe captured it essentially in one statement. Mm. When he and I keep saying this because it's so appropriate. I said he said, "No one is more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they're free."
Yeah.
And that's us.
Yeah,
that's what we are.
It's interesting.
We get in the road. If we get it, we become an impediment to anything that the governments want to do. Like, for example, Julian Assange. You got to get rid of him.
Yeah.
Put him in a place where he can't say anything. Or like Kim.com, they're trying to get him now.
Yeah.
Saying things they don't want said. So you got to get rid of him.
Yeah.
Or like Elliot Spitzer, who tried to hold the bankers on Wall Street criminally responsible for fraud, on, you know, passing around those mortgage packages. So, and that was clearly fraud.
Yeah.
They went into the negative.
You know what's fascinating is that, you know, hardly ever goes to jail from a white, you know, for white collar crimes in the global financial crisis. I don't know whether there are any figures. I'm sure there aren't. But how can you quantify the amount of damage that's done, the amount of people who have died from lack of money or suicide, the amount, just the sheer amount of misery that has been caused from people getting rich on mortgage scams?
Well, also look at the ones that we've used to create wars, like the slam dunk weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
We go up and kill a couple hundred thousand people in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then, and then take for example, the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
We start off with the Tonkin Gulf affair, the attack that the North Vietnamese were supposed to have made on one of our destroyers.
Yeah.
The captain of that destroyer was telling everybody, no, there was no attack.
There was no attack.
Yeah. They made it up and said, okay, let's go to war. And we go over there and kill a couple million people.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this is just insane.
It is. It is. Again, referring to my background, I used to live in Guatemala as well. And but prior to moving there, I didn't know about the United Fruit Company. Have you heard about the United Fruit Company and all their Machiavellian plans in Central America? Yeah, that's another interesting one. But safe to say that a lot of the problems in Latin America exist as a result of A, humans being humans, so that's got nothing to do with the United States. B, colonizing empires, like the Spanish being colonizing empires. Yeah. And then C, their younger, you know, their baby brothers, United States, being, you know, quite interested in toppling, you know, potentially democratic leaders in place instituting their, you know, their preferred candidate. And this is it always makes me laugh, sadly laugh, when I see the, you know, the mentions of Russian meddling. I'm thinking, oh, come on, guys. You know, yeah, sure, Russia, it meddles. It's got 44 on its tally as countries, give or take. I mean, United States has got 70. Don't worry, you guys got the crown. And, you know, Guatemala, General Mont, and Noriega, Pinochet. Sure, this is the other thing, right? You know, the analysts who are sitting, the 6,000 analysts in your team, and you yourself, who are sitting within this in intelligence vessel, who are advising and working with politicians, and even politicians, probably, you know, some politicians are dicks, I have to say. But, you know, not everyone's a bad person. Some people are out to get for the benefit of the country, but they're not thinking it in a zero-sum game. And yet, as a result of the accumulation of some of this analysis, some of this intelligence, the advice is, let's institute person X, and this person has America's best interests at heart. And yet, it just completely it eviscerates any credibility. It eviscerates any development within the country. I mean, we even see that in Iran. I mean, Iran had its democratically elected prime minister, and, you know, goodbye. And now Iran is the pariah. Now, obviously, Iran, the leaders of Iran, I've never been to Iran, so how do I know? But from sources of mine and from what I understand, it's the leaders aren't great now. But that could have been solved by not actually ousting the guy in the first place.
Yep, that's right.
I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts? Do you have really strong, mixed feelings about having, you know, worked for what is a necessary institution in many senses and yet what is a far-reaching mechanism for people who are, you know, quite high on the pay grade in others? Or?
Well, the message I have, very simply put, is I put into, affidavits and made statements publicly. I said, basically, they belong in jail.
Yeah.
Once we put them in jail, this kind of activity will stop. I blame this all on Jerry Ford.
So when you say they, I was going to ask, who's they?
Bush, Cheney, Hayden, Tenet, and the four main ones, plus all the lawyers that wrote and fabricated legal statements to justify it, plus all the members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and Judiciary Committees that knew about this and supported this kind of activity, plus the members of the FISA Court who approved all the warrants. I mean, just take, for example, that warrant that they first exposed from the Snowden material that was from the FISA court to Verizon that said, turn over all the data you have on your 110 plus million people. Mm. That's a general warrant that's in violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. These people need to be tried for that.
Yeah.
You know, they don't belong. They're not judges. They need to be disbarred and tried.
Yeah.
And so, once we start doing that first with the Bush administration and do the same people in the Obama administration, including a lot of the heads and management in NSA, CIA, FBI, and the DOJ, and the DHS, then go and do the same people in the Obama administration. And then, if we want to, then we can go and try Edward Snowden. Because that would take the crimes in order of order of execution, right? That's why I thought we should apply the laws equally and do it in chronological sequence of the crimes,
Let's go.
There's only a couple thousand people in front of Edward Snowden.
It's got a bit of a weight.
Yeah, I just call these people criminals outright on radio and TV.
Yeah.
And I tell them why they're criminals.
Yeah.
And so far, I've not been taken to court. So I'm trying to get there, suing everybody myself.
An interesting question. Well, a question for you. I mean, when we started communicating, I mean, you're active on social media and LinkedIn, at least. When we communicated, you're using an email. I won't obviously name the email on a podcast, but... it's not an email that I understand to be something like a Proton. It's not a Proton Mail email, for example. Do you not bother about security anymore? You already know the capacity of where the former workplace. So what's the point?
Yeah. Plus, I'd like them to know exactly what I think of them.
Yeah. There's that.
I don't give them any credit whatsoever.
Yeah.
They're just bumbling idiots.
Well,
what's happening in the world, for Christ's sake?
Yeah, yeah.
We're surprised by the Russians going into Crimea or the eastern Ukraine. Why? Like, what that says is they've lost the expertise of intelligence production.
What do you mean by that? Let's pull on that thread.
Let's say when I was working the Soviet Union or the Russian problem, I knew them like the back of my hand, and I could tell every time they were getting ready to do something in the real world. It was very clear to me there was no, and I could hit every time they started doing something, I knew it.
But
and I knew it in advance.
How, more or less? I mean,
okay. Well, those are classified ways. Okay.
Yeah.
There were only five. I had five indicators that I looked at to make these determinations.
Okay.
And they were critical to the essence of what their basic policy was that they wrote up in their doctrine.
Okay. Okay.
So, and if you, the trick was to know how to recognize each of those. Doctrinal issues,
and how much do you think the mentality at the top, let's say Putin and then down, has that changed? What are your thoughts on Russia now? Because obviously Russiagate, you have very strong opinions of, which are quite well supported.
For the DNC data that WikiLeaks posted, right? They posted this. There were 35,816 emails posted. Each of them showed a modified time to the nearest even second of the last modification.
Okay.
That was the file allocation table format that was used, something that read it to a storage device, which said, very simply, that was not a hack. That was a download to a storage device like a thumb drive or a CD-ROM.
Now, when you presented this evidence in public, because I remember watching this on TV or YouTube, I can't remember, what was the response? Because
everybody ignored it. Nobody wanted to talk about it. I didn't even get interviewed. The only thing that happened was the president told Director Pompeo of CIA, if he wanted to know facts about Russiagate, he needed to talk to me.
Ask you. Yeah.
So I got an invitation in the CIA 7th floor to go talk to the director of the CIA, Pompeo.
Yeah.
So I went in there and I said, well, I didn't cut him any slack either. I basically said, your agency and all the intelligence agencies in the intelligence community are lying to you and the president, because I'm here to tell him facts. If he doesn't have any facts from any of them, they're lying to him.
How did he take it?
He said, well, I find it hard to believe that, that's doing. We have so many dedicated people here. I said, well, you don't have to believe me. All you have to do is read the DOD IG report 05-intel-03. And you'll learn about the corruption, fraud, waste, abuse, and lying of these agencies.
Yeah.
And don't believe me, go read it. You know, this has been going on, not just in the NSA, but also in all these agencies. Because they get together before they go to Congress or have any meeting with anybody of any significance and say, okay, what's the story du jour, you know?
Mm.
I basically got out of a lot of meetings by saying at one of them, I said, I will not lie to anybody for anybody.
Mm.
I didn't get invited to meetings. That was because that meant I got a lot of things done, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't waste my time to work with meetings.
If nothing else, you achieved not getting in meetings.
Exactly.
So, I mean, with the Russiagate scandal.
I kept asking, what did the Russians really do? Oh, they said they spent $100,000 on Facebook ads. Oh, 50,000, greater than, a little over 50,000 of it was spent after the election.
Yeah.
46,000 was spent before.
Yeah.
And most of that was about cats or, you know, pregnancies and stuff like that. Nothing about politics.
And I've seen some of the meddling attempts and the pictures with the Jesus and the Satan. And I mean, they're literally degrade.
Yeah, yeah. What are you going to say? You know, who's that going to convince of anything? I mean, after all, if we as a country can't accept the multiple views, I mean, that's what diplomacy has always been. I mean, that's why we had Radio Free Europe and all of that. That was all about the same thing, trying to influence things.
Mm.
So everybody does that. So, I mean, if anything, you know, BBC and the other Al Jazeera and all these other radio and TV stations in the U.S. are trying to influence the U.S.
Absolutely, yeah.
For example, Cambridge Analytics, when they helped all do all this advertising across the web, I mean, they were trying to interfere too. So, and that's a U.K. facility. Like, what? You know, we have more interference from our allies than we do from our potential enemies.
Yeah. So. Well, I guess there can be benign propaganda and malicious propaganda, right? You know, if I'm trying to change the minds of people to be more aware of cancer, sure, I'll do some.
Yeah.
You know, maybe black SEO might justify my my manipulation of people's people's bank accounts so that they give a bit more money to X cancer research. Out of interest, what are your thoughts on what are your reflections on climate change, the ability to make people aware and also states aware and act on an increasing temperature, which certainly is, you just have to look at a graph in Milan or Paris to know that last week it was 42 degrees in Paris. That's it's not Bangladesh, it's Paris. What are your reflections on that and maybe the versatility in the use of all-encompassing technological constructs that, say, facilities like the NSA have in order to sway public opinion and even nation-state opinion and response to something as complex and global as climate change? Any thoughts?
Well, I've got a number of thoughts about climate change from the scientific way. Okay, in other words, this is something where you look at the science, not just over the last 100,000 years, but after the last 400 million years.
Okay.
And when you do that, you can see all these fluctuations in the ratio of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to other things, you know, going all the way back to basically when dinosaurs were out there, where they, you know, I think the carbon content in the atmosphere length was about roughly four times what it is now.
And this is from core samples that you're talking about there?
Well,
there.
Core samples and rock samples, things like that. And, you know, that's how they can tell, for example, looking at the rocks that are iron in them, how the iron oriented itself, as the rock cooled, right? over the years, they could see a cyclical pattern of about every 25,000 years, the magnetic pole of the Earth flips, north becomes south, south north, and so on. So, you know, there's a lot of long-term things that happen, and certainly a temperature. And if you looked at it again, the science says very simply that the temperature rose first and was followed by a carbon dioxide increase, not the reverse. So if you looked at it, it trailed, the carbon dioxide trailed the temperature rise by 100 to 800 years.
So,
and some people explain it or try to at least explain it, saying that it's because once you raise the temperature of the Earth, the ocean heats up, and that means the ocean holds less carbon dioxide when it's heated, so that it's emitting all this carbon dioxide out of the ocean. And so therefore, after the heating, then the ocean emitting the carbon dioxide increased that in the atmosphere.
Okay, so what I mean, how would you rebut the multitude of scientists and who were supporting the United Nations, or who were a part of United Nations and other global organizations and institutions who don't agree with that position?
I would say, hey, I just go by the facts. The facts are, over these millions of years, this is what's going on.
Mm.
And, you know, if you can show some other facts, facts is they can't do that. So they don't debate, people who are in the business of climate and studies and rock studies and things like that, and accumulating. These are the true scientists, not the ones they have the puppets out in front.
Mm.
Who claim things but can't have an open discussion with them in public, so we can actually see who knows what they're doing.
Mm.
You know, that's my problem with it. Mm. I just need to see them get together and be out there in public and really address the issue openly and honestly.
Mm.
That is, if you remember, the first initially when they started talking about this climate change, they were modifying the data itself or ignoring data. That was a bad thing. They just cut out data that didn't agree with the argument they were saying. And that was a bad thing. That gave you a very bad taste in your mouth about whether or not the credibility of these people was right there or not. So, you know, and if you looked at some of the studies they've done in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide emitted by humans, I think it's less than 5%.
Yeah.
Contributed by humans. The rest of it is basically from the oceans or from volcanoes and things of that nature.
Well, in the show notes, I'll have to sort of sift around and look at any scientific publications that we can post links to and feel
free. Yeah, it's on the web too. There's a lot of scientists who have been talking about this since early 2000s. Yeah.
Okay. I guess we'll close off the Russiagate piece, and then I know that you've been very, very generous with your time, and then we'll end up, I guess, seeing what you're doing now and what you're, you know, whether you're pessimistic, optimistic, or, you know, blasé about
this. Yeah, yeah.
But Russia, less Russiagate. What about Russia as a country, as a cyber force to be reckoned with? What about China as a cyber force to be reckoned with?
Yeah, well,
let's cut off Russia first. So, you know,
Russia doesn't even compare to China.
Sorry?
China is really the major major player in international hacking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, they are the main ones. Then the rest of them are basically our allies.
Yeah.
And then after that is Russia. So that's probably a priority right there.
Okay. that gives us something.
But
they've got nukes, and therefore, you know, we can position them as this big bad enemy effectively. I mean, if we were sort of go hacking skill, what about skills versus skills? I mean, you know, maybe there's a lot more discipline, structure, funding, and maturity in the intelligence apparatus of the NSA. But what about the skills that you face within say some of the Russian guys?
Well, I think for the skills, I think still the Chinese have greater skills than the Russian, because I think they've been doing it more and longer. But the real kicker is access, you know, and the Russians don't have the access, for example, that the Five Eyes do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, I mean, they've got tens of thousands of implants around the network worldwide. They've actually owned switches everywhere in the world. So, you know,
yeah.
It's not a question of them not being able to get data anywhere. So it's like Merkel when she said, our parliament is like three blocks away from the U.S. embassy, and that's where they're getting they're collecting us from the embassy. She didn't realize, you know, she could go anywhere in the world and they get any local switch, she'll send it to them. Because when you go on your cell phone, you know, it goes to the local tower and it goes into the network. well, that's got a switch, you know, and that switch routes you all around. Huh. And they own the switches, you know. So she could be in Brazil and be collected in NSA.
Before we end, I almost forgot, sorry, like drawing a connection with European Union, because the majority of this podcast is from the European Union. I try and this is a European Union focused initiative. Tell us a bit about that background, actually.
Actually, I did get to discuss with the vice president of the European Union Parliament. She was a Austrian, she was from Austria, and we showed her the movie A Good American and said there are ways to fix this stuff, you know, and here's how you can fix it. And we explained the deductive, inductive, abductive approach and how you can get everybody privacy and get security at the same time. That was a lie from the beginning. You didn't have to sacrifice one for the other. Mm. We basically advised her on some things on how to get the privacy back in and laws in the EU. And I think we were contributing then to the GDPR kind of output from the parliament, from the EU parliament. So it became law. I know they're still struggling with that as to how to implement and everything. So
yeah. And it's
not the right idea. You know?
What about the Merkel case? So this caused a huge furore. And for listeners who aren't familiar, you must have been living under a rock, but Merkel understood through Snowden leaks that she was actually being targeted as part of as one of the many surveillance programs. Is that correct?
That was the statement publicly, yeah.
Okay.
the German committee that was investigating the Bundestag, I mean the BND.
Yeah, yeah.
The group of people there, that I testified to them, by the way.
Okay.
They eventually found out that the BND was cooperating with NSA and feeding them all the data they were collecting, even on German citizens.
Everything.
So BND was doing that. And they had the query program XKeyscore to go in the database that NSA stored to query the data. And so they found out about this. And guess who knew about it in the German government?
Who?
Merkel and a very few people at the top. And the people who were the, like the president of the BND and his major people. So the main people that knew about it were they put up this charade. Oh, you're copying me. Oh, woe is me. Oh, not only are you doing that, you're copying every other German citizen in my country, you know? And my government's helped you do it, you know? Well, the same is true in the UK. I mean, in the UK, they put that Bude facility in to capture all the communications across the transoceanic cables, right?
Mm.
Right down there on the toe of England, right?
Mm.
And all the cable service. Mm. Well, guess who paid for that facility? Roughly $250 million were given to them to build it by the NSA. Right. And then what do you do in return? Oh, you give us all the data you collect.
Thank you very much, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. And oh, by the way, well, a good deal of that's on UK citizens. And oh, by the way, everywhere else we're collecting. Oh, we're going to give that to you too, so you have your central database. You guys pay billions to store it, and we'll take advantage of that too. Thank you.
It reminds me, this is just conjuring up a memory of Pine Gap down in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the initial pushback from one of our former prime ministers, who was then conveniently ousted and replaced by Fraser. You know, you might be familiar with this story. Can you recount this? And then we'll move to the last.
No, I'm not familiar, but I know what you're talking about. But I just am not familiar with that replacement. When did that replacement happen?
Look, that was, let me just Google that, Gough Whitlam. So he was a Labor leader. He was certainly endorsing of a a patient of an allied partnership. And it's not even complex. It's like, okay, if I want to be friends with someone, then I'll maintain the friendship, but I will have certain boundaries. No, the friend can't come over to my house unannounced. I'll say, mate. Yep. You want to come over at 3 o'clock, we'll have a beer. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Other than that, this was the case which really put into question the influence and the strength, or the influence of external parties, and that can be allied parties or non-allied parties, but in this case, allied parties, and then also the strength of our republic, which ironically, and I say that ironically, we're still part of the Commonwealth. So it's not the Republic of Australia, it's the Commonwealth of Australia. But I think it was 1975, and Gough Whitlam was quite opposed to any plans to develop joint operations facilities. And again, this is where I don't think it's...
So he had to go.
Yeah, he knew, and I don't think it's when you say, my name's Nick, my mate, yeah, Bill, he and I are working on a project to secure this, you know, this park in our neighborhood. And we're going to work on that together, and then we'll go our separate ways at the end of the day. And he goes to his family, I go to my family, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it's understandable. It's what happens in intelligence, what happens in military. You do joint operations exercises. Then you do the diplomatic, you know, hugging the shoulder and the tapping and everything. Yeah. It's fantastic. It's necessary. And that's a reason why, you know, I get to have food on my plate, and I have a supply chain which provides me with a notepad and a pen and plastic. Which is made in China, and it's all civil and known. There's a lot of good stuff there.
Yeah.
So 100%, I advocate and support the institutions that actually make that happen. But some of the bollocks, to use a British/Australian term, it's undeniable. But anyway, that's my rant for the day.
Well, that was a little early for me. I just started at NSA, so I've been 5 years at NSA. I wasn't involved in that kind of a relationship at that time, so. Later on, I would have been. So,
I'll shoot you privately some information on it. And again, it's just another stamp in the book, right? But look, I do appreciate you being extremely generous with your time, and 1,000% loved this conversation. And I could go on for another 10 hours, but I'm sure that probably your grandkids might get a bit annoyed. Let's wrap it up. What are your thoughts about the future? Take that question very generally and just answer with
okay, what you yeah.
And where can we find you? Because I know that Pretty Good Knowledge is an initiative that I believe you started maybe a year or two ago. So we'll do those two and then we'll wrap up.
I don't have too many websites because I'm not really pushing a book or anything. So, but it's prettygoodknowledge.org.
Yep.
Also, I always say people should look at exposedfacts.org. prettygoodknowledge.eu, I'm sorry, and exposedfacts.org. And I didn't have too many others, but, you know, you can get into, there's a whole write-up on me and the Pretty Good Knowledge. So you have to look around there.
That's all right. And the prognosis for the future, I mean.
That's where I'm going now. That's what I was going to do now. So, Actually, I'm actually a little more pessimistic than I have been before.
Okay.
And this was the reason I did vote for President Trump, because he really was our only hope to fix this problem. Everybody else was a member of the get along to go along thing. And they were all advocates because they were all making money on it. You know, they were part of this deep state military industrial intelligence governmental complex. Like Hillary Clinton was a warmonger. She wanted to go, she went after Libya, get rid of Gaddafi. She went after Syria. She agreed to Iraq. You know, she wanted another war with Iran. Heard a number of other people in the military, industrial, intelligence, governmental complex. We had a bunch of warmongers there. And they were about to do that, start something there with Iran again because they were pushing President Trump. But he turned around and said, no. He said, they shot down an unmanned drone and you're telling me I'm going to reciprocate with killing 150 of their people? That's not proportional and it's not appropriate. I mean, you don't kill people just because they shoot down an unmanned drone. Nobody got hurt. So, and he went against the entire military intelligence complex and all that. And he also attacked the intelligence. I keep trying to help him do that too. And I'm helping through other means to try to assist in this process.
It's interesting because, like, you know, you would face a lot of adversity overseas with news constantly lambasting Trump. And I mean, personally,
it's an old sophistic technique. It's called repetition, that's all. And there's no substance behind repetition.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I don't actually think I like Trump. I've never met him, but his actions, some of his actions to me don't speak of a guy who I agree with or whose integrity I believe to be, you know, on top. And yet here's the and yet. I'm human and I've fucked up heaps of times. So I know that if, let's say, for example, in some strange universe, the BBC tried to pull apart my life, I'd be screwed. All of the bad stuff that I have done, which is not too bad. Let's face it. Well, it's not too bad. You know, I'm not an arsehole. Yeah. I'm not violent or anything. But, you know, I've been a dick sometimes. And if they were to scrutinize and unearth that and repeat that constantly, yeah, I'd be in a bad position. Now, this doesn't change the fact I wouldn't vote for Trump personally. Not now. Initially, though, if I were a United States citizen several years ago when he was pitching for office, yeah, he did actually have my vote, and that really pisses off a lot of my friends on the left, because I also consider myself on the left, and yet here was a guy who was like, you know what, screw you, and I'm torn. I'm very torn.
You know, I look at it. He's starting to address the secret government, the shadow government. He's starting to put those people out. They're starting to get rid of those people. They're also going to be with the Attorney General Barr. I think they're going to start with indictments, the referrals to indictments to a grand jury. And when that starts, he's taking down this secret government we have, which is the one advocating the bulk acquisition of everybody, violating everybody's privacy, using that data to put people in jail, and using that data also to threaten people around the world.
So here's a question. Barr recently just brought up something which is, you know, decades old and 5 years old, and decades old from their clipper chip and 5 years old discussion about encryption and backdoors and all that kind of bollocks. He's brought it up again, but the way he constructed this argument was just, it was literally like going in a time machine, going back 5 years ago, and it's like, no, you can't. It's bullshit. Sorry. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, see, this gets back to the loss of intelligence production capability, because with the Soviet Union, I didn't need anything decrypted from any encryption system to figure out what they're doing. I didn't need anything. Based on the open source, the open available data.
Yeah.
You know, if you know how to do that, then that's not a problem. And just because you can't read something doesn't make any difference.
So why is he pushing this angle again?
Because of the FBI, they're afraid. You know, because of the CIA, they want to read things. They want things to be readable to them.
Do you have sympathy for that angle? Because certainly I do, and I know people in policing. I know, you know, some guys in people in various organizations, one in particular, which is looking at child trafficking, where certainly
you don't need to read anything to put that entire worldwide network together.
Yeah, but to put a case together, doesn't content help in some cases? Like it adds to the effectiveness of the case. Otherwise, the guy goes free. You know?
Why? Because you have to read material? Nah, you don't need that. I mean, you can tell when they're getting ready to move people. You can tell when they're getting ready to attack. You can tell all kinds of things from just things that aren't from decryptions. I mean, you could do all that. People don't realize what you can do. If you really study something, you can tear them apart. So you can put the police there when they're starting to do something, arrest them. You've got the evidence right there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's just that people aren't, and they want to take the easy route out. They want to read what people are saying. That's the easy way. They don't want to do the mental work that it takes to get to an answer without reading something.
Yeah, because I was going to say certainly in special cases, content would be valuable. In the majority of cases, locating a, let's say, a hypothetical scenario, a murderer who makes a contact and then his phone hits the tower at X location, yes, it's going to be him. Metadata is sufficient. Don't need content. We've got just cause.
Also addressing the 9/11 when the attack was about to happen could have been diagnosed without any reading of anything
in a system that you designed before. Why? And here's the question. Why? Well, here's another question. Many questions. Why didn't that go through? Was there internal?
Well, because they needed to. Yeah. See, at the time, this was a program. I spent $3,200,000 roughly on it. To do it from the scratch. We have it operating 24 hours a day at three different sites. Unfortunately, those sites were looking the Far East.
Yeah.
So the point was, it was too cheap. His first request for the first 5 years of the Trailblazer program, that is Hayden's request to Congress, was for $3.8 billion. That was 1,000 times the amount it cost for us to develop our whole program from scratch. And his attempt was to handle volume, velocity, and variety. We already solved that problem in the thin thread program.
So
we had to get rid of it to continue justifying that amount of money.
So what actually perpetuates someone's mentality? Like, is that ego, would you say? Because if you can do it for cheaper, then you would do it for cheaper. That makes sense.
Well, if you're reasonable, yeah, absolutely. But if you're focused on trying to create an empire and becoming a bigger bureaucrat, managing a bigger budget and a bigger staff, that doesn't make any sense at all.
There's a podcast I listen to. It's a Buddhist podcast, and it talks about, you know, life and death and the fact that, you know, all these empires and everything, at the end of the day,
Yeah, exactly.
We're all just dust. So all these worries and concerns, it's, you know, they don't mean anything. I've thoroughly enjoyed this, and I wish we could talk for another 10 hours, but
Good laughs there too. So
well, that's it. That's it. And you know, what's life without laugh?
Exactly. Yep.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'll be posting this after the European holidays because
Yeah.
So probably mid September, late September. But definitely look forward to catching up with you somewhere in the world somehow. And thank you so much for your time.
Oh, great. It was good talking with you.
Cheers.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.